Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In the political ferment of the early 20th century in New York City, when socialists and reformers battled sweatshops and writers and artists thought a new world was being born, an immigrant Jewish woman from Russia appeared in the Yiddish press, in Carnegie Hall, and at rallies. She fought for socialism, contraception, and workers' rights. Her name was Rose Pastor Stokes, and what set her apart was not just the strength of her speeches or the passion of her commitments, but her marriage to James Graham Phelps Stokes, the Episcopalian son of one of the oldest and most elite families in the United States. The book, Rebel Cinderella, From Rags to Riches to Radical, The Epic Journey of Rose Pastor Stokes, illuminates this unlikely marriage, an era of great hopes, and how Rose Pastor Stokes rose from obscurity to fame before all but vanishing. I'm Rob Snyder, a Manhattan Borough historian and professor emeritus of American Studies and Journalism at Rutgers University, Newark. Today I'm talking with Adam Hochschild, author of Rebel Cinderella. Adam is a master of deeply researched narrative history and is the author of 10 books, among them King Leopold's Ghost, a story of greed, terror, and heroism in colonial Africa, and Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War. He's won widespread recognition for his writing and received the Theodore Roosevelt Woodrow Wilson Award of the American Historical Association. We hear thanks to the Gotham Center for New York City History and the New Book Network. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be with you.
How did you encounter Rose?
Well, I noticed her name for the first time this way. Many years ago, in the early 1990s, I was researching and writing a book about how Russians were coming to terms with Stalinism. My family and I lived in Russia for 6 months, and I interviewed people who were digging up mass graves and who'd been in the Gulag and retired secret police folks and so forth. And in my reading of Soviet history, I, at one point in the Hoover archives at Stanford, I came across a photograph of the American delegates to a 1922 meeting of the Communist International in Moscow. And there in the front row was this quite striking-looking woman with a rather Jewish face and this New York high society name, Stokes. And I was so struck by this that I actually made a photocopy of this picture, put it aside, and thought, this is somebody I need to look into sometime. Then I kind of got distracted by various other books that I was writing. And then 5 or 6 years ago, looking around for a book subject, I was reading a lot of early 20th century American history and realized that I was not the first person to notice this woman. And moreover, I realized that even though her name had previously been unfamiliar to me, and I suspect is unfamiliar to 99.9% of American readers, at the time she lived, she was extraordinarily well known. In fact, a survey done by a newspaper clipping service found that for the years roughly 1918 to 1921, she was the woman whose name appeared most in American newspapers. There were half a dozen men like Woodrow Wilson and Henry Ford who were mentioned more often, but she was the woman whose name was most mentioned. So that set me on the trail. Who was this person? Why was she so well known? And so forth.
So in your book, you quote Mabel Dodge, who hosted a famous Greenwich Village salon in New York City in the years before World War I. And about that time, she wrote, "Barriers went down and people reached each other who had never been in touch before." Why did that happen, and how do Rose Pastor and Graham Phelps Stokes fit into this?
Well, as I began writing the story of this remarkable marriage, and we'll get to the details of that, I realized, and in fact was greatly helped in realizing this by a wonderful editor I worked with, Tom Engelhardt, I realized that their story was also really a chance to tell the story of the progressive era in the United States, that remarkable decade or so just before the United States entered the First World War, when this country was alive with social and intellectual ferment, and where such an extraordinary array of people centered in New York City, centered in Manhattan. So I envy you being a Manhattan borough historian. I'm a native Manhattanite myself, but I live in California. Centered in New York City, here were these people, many of them attending Mabel Dodge's salon, who hoped to change the world and had this tremendous confidence that they could do so. And all of these folks came into the lives of Rose and Graham Stokes. Okay, well, her story, she'd been born in Tsarist Russia, and she fled there with her divorced mother when she was 3 years old, settling first in London, because after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II, the reformer czar, there was a series of terrible pogroms in Russia, and that, of course, is what set off the enormous immigration of Russian Jews out of the country, especially to the United States. So she and her mother came to Cleveland, Ohio in 1890, and Rose lived there for the next 13 years of her life. She immediately had to go to work as a factory worker in a factory making cigars. And by the end of those 13 years, when she was 23 years old, she was the sole support of herself, her mother, and six younger siblings who had been abandoned by a ne'er-do-well alcoholic stepfather. Rolling cigars is hard work. You know, these were, you worked 8 or 10 hour days. She often worked evenings as well, trying to get enough money to help the family scrape by. Cigar factories were terrible places. The air was filled with tobacco dust, and cigar workers had the second highest rate of tuberculosis in the United States. Only stonecutters had it worse. She did this work for 13 years. At the end of that, and no schooling during this time. She had had 2 years of formal schooling when she was in London, learned to read and write English there. She spoke Yiddish at home, and mostly in the cigar factory as well. By the end of that time, she had started writing occasional pieces for a Yiddish language newspaper in New York for its English language page. And to her astonishment, when she was 23 years old, the newspaper invited her to come to New York and work for them as a reporter at double the salary she was making as a cigar worker. So she saw her wages soar from $8 a week to $15 a week, which was a reasonable salary in those days. $8 was not. So she arrived in New York City at the age of 23 in 1903.
So now you've worked as a journalist and you helped found the magazine Mother Jones. How would you rate Rose as a journalist in those years?
Rose is a fascinating and remarkable human being. I would not give her high marks as a journalist. I don't think anything that she wrote was terribly distinguished. But I think what distinguishes her is several things. One is that she quickly became renowned as one of the great radical orators of her day. And there's account after account by other people who heard her speak, writing her letters saying, this is the best speech I ever heard, or accounts by newspaper reporters who said, you know, the audience wouldn't leave the hall after Mrs. Stokes had finished speaking, even though the lights were turned off. You know, one account after another like that. And if you read her speeches, you can see how artful she was at talking to whatever audience she was talking to. If she was talking, and these speeches, by the way, were mostly promoting the Socialist Party, in which she was a very active member. If she was talking to an audience of factory workers, she spoke about her own experience in the cigar factories and what it was like and what she learned about speed-ups and so on. If she talked to a religious audience, as she did, for instance, going to the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York, she made her points about socialism by using quotations from the Bible. So she was a magnificent speaker and impressed everybody who heard her. My one regret as a writer in writing this book is that it was just too early for there to be any recordings or film of her talking. When you're before World War I, it's hard to find. So I couldn't find that. The other way in which I think she was distinguished as a person, though not particularly as a journalist, was that she made a remarkable journey in her own life. You know, after having worked nothing but this grueling factory work for 10 years, she suddenly came into a new world by virtue of her marriage to Graham Stokes. James Graham Phelps Stokes was his full name, but his friends called him Graham. By virtue of that marriage, she came into a world of extremely wealthy New Yorkers, but also a world of socialist and radical intellectuals, you know, people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Lincoln Steffens and John Reed and Mabel Dodge, whom you mentioned, and all kinds of other people. And she was able to be at ease in both those worlds. She was able to get along with her husband Graham's family quite well, even though their socialist ideas were anathema to his family. She was able to preserve relations with them, and she was able to, you know, get to know all this extraordinary range of people and to be at ease with people of different classes, you know, so she could, you know, have dinner with Lincoln Steffens and John Reed one night, and then the next she would be out giving a speech in Yiddish to striking clothing workers.
I mean, she sounds like someone with an extraordinary degree of empathy.
Yes, I think so. And there are several different accounts by people who knew her of that empathy, of her bursting into tears when confronted with human suffering in one way or another. So I feel I would have really liked her as a human being.
Mm-hmm. How did she meet Stokes?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, she spent all of her adolescence and young adulthood as a cigar worker in Cleveland, then was invited by this newspaper, the Yiddish's Tageblatt, or Jewish Daily News, to come to New York, work for them as a reporter. This she did, and about 6 months into that job, which had mainly was mainly, you know, writing feature stories about the neighborhood, which was the Lower East Side, which was the Lower East Side itself was the largest Jewish in the world at that point. And this was a paper that had to fill up that English page every day, and you can almost imagine the editor telling her, we've still got 15 inches we need to fill. Having worked at a small newspaper myself, I know what that's like. But then one day the editor sent her to interview somebody who worked at a settlement house. And you know what settlement houses were, these places that provided adult education classes, baths and showers for people in tenements who didn't have them, after-school activities for children, all kinds of uplift stuff for poor neighborhoods. The neighborhoods that settlement houses served were almost all immigrant and poor, like this particular settlement house, which is still there, incidentally, the university settlement on the Lower East Side. But the people who staffed the settlement houses as volunteers were almost all well-to-do college graduates. So the guy she was sent to work, sent to interview at the settlement house was this man, James Graham Phelps Stokes, who came from the most different kind of background imaginable. As you can tell from the name, he was Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and his family was one of the great American fortunes, originally derived from the Phelps Dodge mining empire, but they had branched out into real estate in New York, mainly luxury apartment buildings on the Upper East Side. They also owned a cluster of gold and silver mines in Nevada and a railroad leading to them. And Graham Stokes was supposed to be sort of the scion of this family, but somewhat to his parents' disgruntlement, he had combined that role with this interest in socialism and social reform and uplift and was working in this settlement house. So Rose went to interview him there and they fell in love and they courted secretly for 2 years. And then, much to the well-concealed dismay of his family, they got married in 1905. And the marriage was literally front page news in the New York Times. It was the lead story in the New York Evening World. It was reported all over the United States, in England, in Australia. I've looked at these clippings because it was so unusual. You know, this guy from this enormously wealthy family marries a factory worker, and even more unusual, this was a marriage of Jew and Gentile, which was unheard of in those days. So it was, you know, both a marriage with a class difference and an ethnic difference. And of course, we're still interested in that kind of thing, you know, as everybody follows the marriage of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle today. Well, that's a good question, Rob, because it's always hard to get inside somebody else's marriage. But in a way, as a writer, I felt I had golden material to work with because they left so much in the way of written records. They kept all their letters back and forth over the decades, and letters that other people wrote to them, they wrote to other people. Each of them wrote a memoir. They are dueling memoirs because this marriage did not end happily. And Rose kept a diary for a while. So what did they see in each other? I think for Graham Stokes, who was 7 years older than Rose, he saw a woman who was more interesting in a sort of exotic way than all these proper, well-bred, WASP young debutantes that he'd grown up with, none of whom he'd shown much interest in before. For Rose, here was this man who, I think she was less attracted to his wealth than to the fact that he knew people like Lincoln Steffens, John Reed, Upton Sinclair. Upton Sinclair, who wrote the novel The Jungle that gave us our food and drug laws, he sent that novel chapter by chapter to Graham Stokes to ask for his critique as he was writing it. So I think Rose was tremendously excited by this whole intellectual world that Graham opened up to her. And she was also, she believed that he was a genius and that he was as smart as all of these writers and intellectuals that he knew. And I think it took her about 5 or 10 years to realize that actually she was a lot smarter than he was. He had multiple graduate degrees, but she had an ability to navigate the world, an ability to talk to people at different class levels that he never had. Well, having grown up in a, as I've mentioned, you know, she had 6 younger siblings. And, you know, this was growing up in extreme poverty in Cleveland, where when her mother got pregnant again and again and again, one of the big worries is, where are you going to get the $10 to pay the midwife to come to the house and attend to the birth? And she saw how that, you know, repeated having of children one after the other had really deepened the family's poverty. And of course, these were the kinds of conditions that huge numbers of people lived with at that time. You know, wealthy women who went to private doctors could confidentially get information about what kinds of birth control techniques were available then, and there were some, not as many as we have today. So she became an ardent backer of birth control at a time when it was forbidden to talk about this kind of thing in public. Margaret Sanger, for instance, the great pioneer in the field, was sent to jail for opening her birth control clinic in Brooklyn. Emma Goldman served a couple of weeks in jail for distributing information about birth control. Rose, I think, hoped to get sent to jail because there was part of her that I think desired some sort of martyrdom. And the most spectacular example of this was when she was speaking in Carnegie Hall at a big rally held to welcome Emma Goldman home from prison, where Goldman had been imprisoned for distributing birth control information. Rose began distributing leaflets about birth control from the stage and, of course, was mobbed because this was forbidden material and everybody was desperate to get their hands on it. And, you know, every newspaper in New York had a reporter at the Carnegie Hall to describe the scene. And they also described the policemen who were in attendance telephoning the station house for instructions on whether or not they should make an arrest and evidently receiving instructions that, no, they shouldn't arrest her. As I say, I think Rose would have liked to have gotten arrested.
You know, several times in the book, you point that Rose was...
Well, I think having been a reporter herself, she knew how newspapers worked, and she knew that reporters always love it when they get access to people. So after this marriage that got a tremendous amount of publicity, as I mentioned, they went off on a European honeymoon. Then they came back and settled in New York in an apartment on the Lower East Side, although a pretty comfortable apartment. But when journalists wanted to come and see what this apartment looked like, she welcomed them. And so we can see photographs of that apartment, and we have descriptions of how Rose did the cooking there. And, you know, yes, they had a cleaning woman who came in once or twice a week, but otherwise no servants. And she was kind of good at curating her public persona. She knew that, and she did a lot of work also helping to publicize the strikes that were taking place in New York at that time. So she worked with newspaper reporters about that. She knew, for example, and you can tell from interviews with her, that one thing a reporter loves when covering a story is to overhear back and forth dialogue. That's journalistic gold. So at one point on a speaking tour, she was in St. Louis, I think, and a reporter came to her hotel to interview her at breakfast. And as the waiter is serving them breakfast, Rose asked the waiter, "Hey, are you in a union?" you know, the reporter reported on that conversation. So
what did World War I do to Rose, to Graham, and to the political milieu they moved in?
Well, World War I really caused a big problem in their relationship. We should remember, of course, that when the war began in Europe in 1914, the United States was not involved, and the United States was officially neutral for the first 2.5 years of the war. I say officially neutral because, in fact, American industry was making huge amounts of money selling munitions to Britain and France, but officially the U.S. was neutral. And the American left was appalled by the war. because, of course, the great hope of socialist parties everywhere had been that the workers of the world would not fight each other. But, of course, they did so very willingly. And so there was great disillusionment. At the same time, the American Socialist Party and most other groups on the left felt strongly that the United States should not join this conflict. And when the U.S. did enter the war in April of 1917, the Socialist Party held an emergency national convention and voiced strong and not quite unanimous, but almost unanimous disapproval of this move, and was persecuted very badly as a result during the remainder of the war. Graham Stokes, however, who had been, had always had a peculiar love for things military. Despite his socialism, he had been in the cadet corps in school and in college, and he had served a year in the Spanish-American War, not overseas, but he'd been in the military here at home and played polo in his cavalry squadman's team. And he decided he was in favor of the United States joining the war, so much so that he actually enlisted and went into uniform. He was 45 years old, so he was too old to be sent overseas, despite trying very hard to make that happen. So he never got closer to combat than marching down Fifth Avenue in parades of his National Guard unit, New York National Guard. But he served in uniform in the New York National Guard for 3 years and felt very important because they were guarding reservoirs and water pipelines and things like that. Rose, after initially going along with his views for the first 6 months, finally decided she didn't agree at all and that it was a terrible mistake for the U.S. to enter the war. And she began saying this in speeches, and this created a tremendous rift between them, which was widened because they disagreed about the Russian Revolution. When the second stage of the Russian Revolution happened, November 1917, Rose was all for it. Graham was totally against it. So from that point on, they went different directions politically, although they remained married for another 7 years, but very uneasily so.
Now, some of Rose's old comrades like Gene Debs and Emma Goldman remained radicals, but had criticisms of the Soviet Union and didn't become communists. But Rose became a fairly doctrinaire member of the Communist Party. In contrast, what do you think explains that path?
That's a good question, and I haven't fully figured it out. I regret it because, I liked her so much in so many other ways. But one of the problems when you're a historian instead of a novelist is that sometimes your characters behave in ways that you wish they wouldn't. You're absolutely right that Debs and Goldman were, they kept their radicalism, their belief in socialism, their passion for social justice, but they both pretty quickly recognized that the Soviet Union was a horror show. Debs spoke of the Vatican in Moscow laying down the law for the rest of the parties in the world. Emma Goldman went to Russia when she was expelled from the United States in 1919 with enormous hopes and became bitterly disillusioned after living there for 2 years. Rose, however, I think one of the things that made her reluctant to question the Soviet Union in any way was that she had gotten into a sort of an intellectual and emotional tug of war with Graham, her husband. And the one clue to this is the following. So Rose, as we've said, she became a pretty doctrinaire communist from the moment of the second phase of the Russian Revolution onward, and then became a member of the American Communist Party and remained so formally for the rest of her life. But after she and Graham separated, very bitterly in 1925. She stalked out of the house angrily and never saw him again. She wrote a very revealing letter to her best friend. And one of the things I like about her is that she could be very open about her feelings. And she wrote to her best friend, who was the novelist Olive Tilford Dargan, and said, you know, the strange thing is, as soon as I left Graham, I've lost all desire to do anything political. I don't want to speak. I don't want to be on the platform. I've lost all desire for that. And indeed, she lived only a few years after that because she got cancer and died at the age of 53. But during those remaining years, she did very little politically. She wrote poetry, she did drawings, and since as a matter of principle she'd refused to accept any alimony from him, she had to go to work to support herself and was reduced to considerable poverty again. But her political activism pretty much ceased at that point. So I think in a way her veering to the far left was in reaction to Graham's veering to the right.
And doesn't she always sort of disappear from the public eye in the late 20s and early 30s?
Absolutely. As long as they were married, and they were married for 20 years, the American press was fascinated with this couple, the rich and the poor, the Jew and the Gentile. And then they, you know, took up this tremendous crusade for socialism. And there are literally thousands of newspaper articles about them. They made front pages again in 1925 when they got divorced. And then because they were no longer a couple, the press completely lost interest in them because neither of them by themselves was doing anything that sort of merited much attention. She dropped out of sight pretty much completely until her illness and death, and really went living in complete obscurity her last 7 or 8 years.
You were born in New York City, and large parts of this book take place here. Are there locations in the city where Rose's life and times come alive for you?
Yeah. I unfortunately grew up in what seemed to me a much less interesting New York than the New York of John Reed and Mabel Dodge and visits by Bill Haywood and all of those people. But I do love the city, and I do feel it's the capital of the world. And I was delighted that some of the research I had to do for this book took me back there, because I mentioned these thousands of letters and other documents they left behind. The bulk of them are in the library at Columbia and the Tamament Library at New York University. And I remember one day after I'd spent a whole day at Columbia, where Graham's papers are, walking back to where I was staying, and I walked across the upper end of Central Park in the late afternoon, and just felt that delight that I get in New York sometimes. I counted, I heard 4 different languages in the space of 10 minutes. And I thought, this city really is the capital of the world. And I think that's the feeling that Rose had. And of course, I, you know, tried to prowl around the parts of the city where she had lived, but the Lower East Side looks pretty different today. You can go to the Tenement Museum, which is a wonderful place to get a feeling of what the old tenements were like in her day. But much of the rest, unfortunately, looks pretty different.
Your book draws on so many sources, among them files from the Bureau of Investigation, which later gets known as the FBI, and prosecutors' papers filed when Rose was charged with violating the Espionage Act. What did your research teach you about the surveillance practices and repression of radicals in Rose's time?
I love surveillance records. I got interested in this first because I was pretty active politically in the 1960s. My then girlfriend, now wife, and I were briefly civil rights workers in Mississippi. And then I was very active in the movement against the Vietnam War. And because of the latter, there was considerable interest in me by the intelligence agencies, even though I was a mighty, mighty low man on that particular totem pole. And thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, in the mid-1970s, after that was passed, I managed to get copies. You know, they send you redacted copies, which name with names of informants blotted out and so forth, of records kept on me by the FBI, CIA, and military intelligence. I'd also been working for Ramparts magazine at that time, which did some major exposés of the CIA. And, you know, I got more than 100 pages of records. And I thought, wow, if they have 100 pages on me, they must have 1,000 on people who were really important in that time, which I was not. And I got fascinated by the way these folks think, because intelligence agencies always assume that the bedraggled radicals they're spying on are as efficient and as a hierarchical and as orderly as they themselves are. But of course, we're not. We're disorganized. We often don't know what we're doing, so on. So I'm always intrigued by what you can learn about the ways of thinking of the spies when you read their records of who they were spying on. So anytime I do a piece of history, I'm always looking for, you know, are there surveillance records? And I've had wonderful fun finding those. I did a book about the First World War, which is in part about the very brave anti-war movement in Britain during this time. And I spent a lot of time in the Scotland Yard records, which are all now available. Actually, for anybody who works in this field, there's a huge trove of material from the Bureau of Investigation that's now easily and publicly available, a lot of it online. So you can look up, you know, whether you're interested in Rose Pastor Stokes or anybody else, you can look up, you know, what the government spies were writing about them, and sometimes even try to figure out who these people were.
Now, you've worked as a reporter and as a magazine editor both. Did that have any impact on how you came to write narrative history?
Yes, I think it did, because when you work as a reporter, you're having to, you know, you're thinking, what can I do to get my story on the front page? When you're working as a magazine editor, which I think is where I really learned the craft, because I did that for about 10 years at Ramparts magazine, then Mother Jones, you're all the time thinking about your writing and the writing of people you're editing. How can this story be better told? Why didn't anybody read this piece I liked so much in the last issue? Because you get some sense of what people are reading when you get responses to a magazine. And I think being an editor is a very good discipline, because it forces you to look at whoever you're editing, whether it's your own writing or somebody else's, how can this story be improved to catch the eye of the reader, to make them turn the page, to bring something alive through observed detail, through character. So that's the way I like to write history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there any authors you read for good examples?
You know, I think I learn more from novelists than anybody mm-hmm. else, mm-hmm. because a novelist, in a way, has to meet a higher standard, in that the novelist has to make us readers interested in people that we've never heard of, that mm-hmm. we don't know about. Whereas if a historian sets out and writes a book about, you know, Abraham Lincoln or George Washington or some other very familiar subject, they'll at least find readers, you know, who have a particular interest in Washington or Lincoln or whatever. But a novelist has to meet a higher standard. So I think if you're a writer studying how to do narration, how to do suspense, how to bring a character alive, there's more to learn from reading good novelists than anybody else. Although there certainly are historians who know those skills and use them very well. Barbara mm-hmm. Tuchman is one of mm-hmm. my heroines on that score.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Toward the end of the book, you include a quote from Rose, which is part of a larger statement that she made on divorce laws. She says, "Love is always justified, even when short-lived, even when mistaken, because during its existence, it enlarges and ennobles the natures of the men and women experiencing the love." What led you to make that choice?
Well, this was something she said when the news of their divorce became public. At that time, this was 1925, in New York State, adultery was the only ground for divorce. And they'd had this very bitter falling out. Neither of them at that point, at the point when they separated, neither of them had been adulterous, but Rose began a relationship after she stalked out of their house. And she tried to get Graham to move the divorce to another state where there were, you know, there could be different grounds for divorce. He wouldn't do it. And so the newspapers, reported this as Rose was the unfaithful party in this marriage. And, you know, someone had observed her coming out of this guy's hotel room and so on. And she, you know, wanted to make a statement about the ridiculousness of these antiquated divorce laws. And that was where the statement of hers that you just read came from. But I applied it at the end of the book to the two of them, saying that there was something ennobling about their love when it worked, in that it made them into more significant figures than either of them would have been alone. I think either of them alone, had they never married each other, the world would not have paid any attention to. Rose wrote sentimental poetry and was working for this small Yiddish newspaper, and I don't think had the kind of talent of her friend, you know, John Reed. Graham never really found a role for himself in life. He was a pretty minor figure in the Socialist Party. He had a hand in running the family business. He got very involved in his National Guard unit, but he never really found a central role. But during the time that they married, they were sort of a symbol that people of very different backgrounds and of different ethnicities, and you know, the difference between Jew and Gentile at that point was huge. Today, nobody thinks anything of it, but then it was a big deal that gap could be bridged and people could find happiness with each other, symbolized the hope for a lot of people. And they were cheered by crowds when they appeared for that reason.
You know, we live in a time of economic globalization that's transforming our cities. We live in a time of enormous economic inequality. What are the lessons of this book for our time?
Well, I think the real lesson is that a lot of these problems that were pinpointed so eloquently and fought so bravely by people in the progressive movement at that time are still with us today. The disparity in income, the disparity in wealth between the top 1% and the bottom 99% today is greater than it was when Rose and Graham married in 1905. You know, we live in a country where there are still tens of millions of people who don't have medical care. There are all kinds of social problems that remain. Yes, living standards as a whole have certainly risen over what they were a century ago. But there are a lot of people living on the margins in this country, and I do think that this last year we've lived through with the pandemic has steepened that curve of income and wealth disparity, has made those differences more stark in every way, and that we can, you know, take lessons from the people who worked very bravely to talk about these problems and to fight to solve them 100 years ago.
You know, I'm struck by how you've written about a lot of radicals, reformers, and dissenters, abolitionists, opponents of Belgian imperialism, British opponents of the First World War and their military relatives, the Americans and the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Is there something special about this generation in the progressive era that you find fascinating?
Well, there is. There's certainly, I'm at all these different points in history, I'm always fascinated by people who fought to make a better world. Whether they succeeded, like this very extraordinary group of people in the late 1700s in England who began agitating against the slave trade and slavery and finally did end slavery in the British Empire, or whether they failed, like the Americans who went off to fight fascism in Spain and sadly lost that war. And the progressives in the first decade and a half of the 20th century in the United States, I think you can say they both succeeded and failed. You know, they failed in the sense that they didn't stop the First World War. They didn't stop the United States from entering it. They didn't achieve all the things they were working for then. But would we have things like Social Security and Medicare today if they hadn't started talking about those things back then? So, you know, I give them a lot of credit. And I'm just also fascinated by the mood of the time, that it was a political and intellectual moment where people, before the terrible news that the First World War had broken out, before that happened, people were so optimistic that this country, especially, and the whole world, was on the verge of a great leap forward. That didn't happen, but I love the mood of expectation that existed then among these folks I was writing about. I'm actually going back to that era because in the course of writing this book, I was just reminded of how once the First World War broke out here, and then it was followed by the Red Scare period, just how severe political repression was in the United States in the years 1917 to 1921. U.S. entry into the First World War provided an excuse to do all kinds of things that people had been wanting to do for a long time. It provided an excuse for press censorship, which became very severe, which started April 1917 with the excuse that the U.S. was now in the war, but it continued for 2.5 years after the war ended. Massive censorship, more than 400 issues of American newspapers, magazines, and other political and other periodicals were banned from the U.S. mail. It provided the excuse for political imprisonment on a large scale. In that era, more than 1,000 people were sent to federal or state prisons for a year or more, solely for things that they had written or said, not for any acts of violence. It provided an excuse, you know, for the government to crush the labor movement, smash the Wobblies, cripple the Socialist Party by arresting all its key leaders. And this is the period that I'm writing about, 1917 to 1921 in the U.S. And I think I've got a good cast of characters through whom to tell the story, which is always my main job when I start off doing a book like this.
Well, we look forward to that book, and we thank you for the books that you've written up to now. Adam Hochschild, thanks for being with us today for the Gotham Center for New York City.
Thank you, Rob. It was a pleasure.